This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yis Wuhib, coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The defenders of what is good and right are being outflanked in too many countries by race-baiting bigots who seek to gain or retain power by wielding prejudice and deceit at the expense of those most vulnerable and ultimately even those who support them initially.
That's Zayed Raad Al-Hussein, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, speaking today at the UN high-level meeting on migrants and refugees in New York. Details coming up.
Also, a 22-year-old Somali-American has been identified as the man who stabbed 9 people at a Minnesota shopping mall on Saturday. And demonstrators in the DRC say President Joseph Kabila must step down when his term ends in December.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, police have identified the man who stabbed 9 people Saturday at a Minnesota shopping mall as 22-year-old Somali-American Dahir Aden. He was shot dead by an off-duty police officer. Police say none of the victims suffered life-threatening injuries. The FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, says the attack in the city of St. Cloud is a potential act of terrorism. St. Cloud is about 110 kilometers northwest of Minneapolis. Leaders of the Somali community in Minnesota condemned the attack. Aden was known in the Somali community and had been working as a security guard. Police Chief William Blair Anderson says the assailant made references to Allah and even asked if one person was a Muslim.
As the new UN General Assembly session begins in New York, a high-level meeting is being held today on the large movements of migrants and refugees. Among those who addressed the meeting was Ambassador William Lacey Swing, Director General of the International Organization for Migration. The IOM has just been made a part of the UN.
Migration has become a megatrend of our century. We live in a world on the move. There have never been so many people in movement, unprecedented human mobility. 1 billion of our 7 billion world are migrants. 1 in every 7 of us a migrant. And where the 244 million international migrants to constitute themselves as a country, they would have a population slightly smaller than Indonesia's and slightly larger than Brazil's. They would have a gross domestic product roughly that of a small to medium-sized European country, and far exceed all foreign aid.
Swing said there are many factors driving migration, including disasters, conflicts, economic problems, environmental degradation, and climate change.
So we're facing also a series that I have not seen in my lifetime of unprecedented, simultaneous, complex, and protracted crises and humanitarian emergencies in an arc of instability that stretches from the western bulge of Africa to the Himalayas. Worse still, there is little prospect that I see to resolve any of these crises in the short to medium term. Widespread, growing anti-migrant sentiment and policies have led to the cruel irony that those fleeing terrorism and fleeing armed conflict are themselves now accused of terrorism and criminality in the public mind of many. Besides the challenges of disasters, we face the demographic challenge of a global north in demographic deficit and a global south with a turgid rate of job creation facing demographic surplus. So our thesis is that migration is inevitable in this century owing to the drivers that I mentioned, necessary if our economies and societies are to flourish, and highly desirable if we have responsible and humane migration policies.
Suing called on UN members to change off current toxic narrative on migration and learn to manage ethnic, cultural, social, and religious diversity.
Migration is not so much an issue to be resolved or a problem to be solved. It is a human reality that together we all have to manage, and to do that, we have to be both responsible and humane. This can be a defining moment for human mobility, beginning with this summit.
Following the head of the International Organization for Migration was Zayed Raad Al Hussein, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
This should not be a comfortable summit. This summit cannot be reduced to speeches and feel-good interviews, a dash of self-congratulation, and we move on. When millions of people see freedom's invitation only through the flapping canvas of a tent, when they carry their children and their possessions on their backs, walking hundreds, perhaps even thousands of miles, when they and their families risk drowning and are kept cramped in appalling detention centers, and once released, risk abuse by racists and xenophobes. There is no cause for comfort here. The bitter truth is this summit was called because we have been largely failing the long-suffering people of Syria and not ending the war in its infancy, failing others in now chronic conflict zones for the same reason, failing millions of migrants who deserve far more than lives marked by cradle to grave indignity and desperation.
He said the defenders of what's good and right are being outflanked by race-baiting bigots.
An epidemic of amnesia is at the heart of this moral collapse in some quarters. Many seem to have forgotten the two world wars. What happens when fear and anger are stoked by half-truths and outright lies? A density of hatred builds up, the pin is pulled, the timer released, and humanity's rendezvous with the demon of world history beckons again. The bigots and deceivers in opposing greater responsibility sharing promote rupture. Some of them may well be in this hall this morning. If you are here, we say to you, we will continue to name you publicly. You may soon walk away from this hall, but not from the broader judgment of we the people, all the world's people, not from us.
That was Raed Al Hussein, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. He spoke today at the UN high-level meeting on migrants and refugees in New York.
Seventy years after they were introduced, antibiotics continue to be life-saving medicines for hundreds of millions of people with infections such as gonorrhea, pneumonia, and staph worldwide. However, the misuse and overuse of antibiotics and other antimicrobials is causing a severe health crisis. That's because strains of bacteria have become resistant to drugs. This week, a high-level meeting of the United Nations General Assembly will address the issue. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Ramanan Lakshmi Narayan of the Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics, and Policy in Washington, D.C.
People are prescribing antibiotics both appropriately and inappropriately. And in many places, people don't even need a prescription to go get an antibiotic. Across South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa, you can pretty much go to a pharmacy and tell them that you have a stomach bug or you might have a respiratory infection, and they will just give you an antibiotic. This leads to massive overuse of antibiotics, particularly because, you know, many of these don't really need antibiotics in the first place, or they might be caused by viral infections, and viral infections don't need antibiotics.
So what is the consequence of this?
Drug resistance is just Darwinian natural selection. What that means is that we wipe out the population that is sensitive to the antibiotic, and we give an advantage to the bacteria that are resistant. So it should come as no surprise that sometimes when we have an infection, that infection is caused by bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics, and therefore the antibiotics don't work.
So paint a picture for me about what will happen if this inappropriate or over-prescription of antibiotics is not checked.
I think we already have a situation where many people are dying of bacterial infections that are untreatable. They might not know it because the death certificate does not say died of a drug-resistant infection. But if anyone that you know died of multi-organ failure because of an infection in a hospital, and I certainly know many, these are folks who basically acquired an infection in a hospital, an infection that was not treatable, and therefore they died. The thing to keep in mind is that drug resistance that is generated in any single country because of antibiotic use can spread to every other country. We had one such bug called NDM1 that first originated in India, and now this bug is in over 120 countries around the world. All that I can say is if we don't have new antibiotics and we continue to abuse the existing antibiotics, we are in serious trouble.
I know that the UN General Assembly is about to convene. What is it that you are recommending to them that they do?
We're looking for three things to happen. One is for there to be clear targets for reduction of inappropriate antibiotic use. The second thing is to have an accountability framework or a high-level coordinating mechanism composed of UN agencies, such as WHO, the World Bank, and many others, to make sure that these targets are met and that countries are taking them seriously. The third thing we'd like to see is sufficient financing to make sure that all countries have the ability to deal with drug resistance and to reduce antibiotic use.
What about the grassroots aspect, though? I mean, when you're on the level of the village and the local pharmacy guy who also sells soda gives you antibiotics, how are we going to get him to stop dispensing these irresponsibly?
You know, that's a great question. Right now, we do hand out antibiotics as if they were, cubes of sugar and quite cheaply as well. But the same sort of transformation that changed people's attitudes and understanding of tobacco, for instance, as something that causes cancer, that's the level of behavioral change we need for antibiotics as well. I would really think that we need a global awareness campaign where in 5 or 10 years from now, every little child who's 5 years old knows that antibiotics are not to be messed around with, that they work only for bacterial infections, and that they should only be given under the guidance of a medical practitioner. We can't just tweak around the edges to solve this massive problem.
Must be a new one.
That was Ramanan Lakshmi Narayan of the Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics, and Policy in Washington, D.C. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, a protest against the president today descended into violence. The interior minister told reporters that 17 people were killed, 3 policemen and 14 civilians. The demonstrators say President Joseph Kabila must step down when his term ends in December. For VOA, William Claus has the latest from Kinshasa.
The singing quickly devolved into angry chanting. Kabila must go, the protesters yelled. People built barricades to block the roads and burned tyres of vehicles in the pro-opposition neighbourhood of Limite. By 7:30 a.m., police were sporadically firing tear gas grenades. This man told VOA that, "We see that all the Congolese are here to reclaim the rule of law. I am a young Congolese and we need a change. We need elections within the constitutional time frame. We will chase Kabila from the country by force." Several thousand opposition supporters were gathering in Limite and at other points around Kinshasa. The plan was to march around the city before a delegation of 50 opposition leaders delivered a petition to the Electoral Commission. The Kinshasa governor had authorized the plan. Instead, the situation quickly became tense and chaotic. Opposition leaders say that police intimidated their supporters, dispersing them as they gathered and blocking their approach to the central meeting place. At midday, riot police and soldiers were stationed on the road leading to that meeting place near the Parliament building. The OA saw security forces stopping at least 5 people who looked to be foreign observers and loading them into the back of vehicles. An opposition leader told VOA by phone that he and others were penned in one of their party headquarters and unable to leave. A Congolese government spokesman told AFP News that the government decided to cancel the demonstration after supporters of veteran opposition leader Etienne Tshisekedi murdered two policemen in Limite. George Kapiamba, the president of the Congolese Association for Access to Justice, told VOA that his team has seen the bodies of seven people who witnesses said were killed by live rounds fired by the security forces. Monday marks the day the DRC's electoral process should have kicked off ahead of November polls, but the Electoral Commission now says that the poll should be pushed off until 2018. It says that time is needed to compile a new voter list. The leaders of the opposition coalition, known as Le Rassemblement, or the Assembly, say President Kabila is deliberately delaying polls to give him more time to change the constitution so that he can run for a third term. Kabila has not spoken publicly on the subject, though some of his supporters have called for a referendum to remove term limits. Across town, behind closed doors, the government and a smaller faction of the opposition are thrashing out an agreement over election dates. Participants in that dialogue have raised the possibility of an interim power-sharing government once Kabila's mandate expires in December, but have given no additional details. The Rassemblement has dismissed this dialogue as a sham and boycotted it. William Clowes for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Zimbabwe police say they did not use bullets to quell demonstrations scheduled for last weekend to protest the failing economy and to call for electoral reforms. The protests were called by a coalition of opposition groups known as the National Electoral Reform Agenda. The French press agency quotes police as saying 21 people across the country were arrested for disorderly conduct. Authorities say that included members of the opposition movement for democratic change, who they accuse of encouraging violence. Activists, on the other hand, said police fired on small groups of protesters outside Harare and arrested 100 people. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yais Wuhib, 22 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. A 22-year-old Somali-American has been identified as the man who stabbed nine people at a Minnesota shopping mall on Saturday. The large movements of migrants and refugees is the main focus of discussion as the UN General Assembly session begins in New York. And demonstrators in the DRC say President Joseph Kabila must step down when his term ends in December. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Egypt is trying to play the role of mediator in Libya, where the UN-backed government of national accord in Tripoli is yet to be endorsed by the House of Representatives in the East. The Egyptians are pushing for a bigger role for military leader Khalifa Haftar, whose forces recently took over four major oil ports. UN Special Envoy to Libya Martin Kobler has met in Cairo with the Secretary General of the Arab League. They discussed possible changes to the UN-sponsored political agreement for Libya. Mohamed Cherkawi is a former member of the UN Panel of Experts and professor of conflict resolution at George Mason University near Washington. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shanawi about Haftar's ambitions after the oil ports take over.
Since May 2014, Haftar has positioned himself as the savior of post-Gaddafi turbulent Libya, and he has affiliated himself with the newly formed government in Tobruk after the elections of August 2014. So Haftar has urged his allies, including House Speaker Aqila Saleh, to prevent the ratification of the General National Accord. So now he is translating his views after he was promoted to the position of field marshal
of the Libyan National Army. And as we have seen, you know, he has always acted as a de facto protector of the national security, including the fight against radical or militant groups, as well as protecting the oil fields across the coast, which were under the control of the powerful petroleum facilities guard forces. As of last Monday, these four areas have been captured by Haftar's men, and he is now aiming at moving further to the west.
From a conflict resolution point of view, what's needed to resolve the continuous division that impeded a political solution in Libya?
Libya happens to be a very complex, protracted conflict. And what is needed now is the deconstruction of three disputed layers of political legitimacy. So far, we have the National Congress, which operates out of Tripoli in the west. We also have the House of Representatives in the east and with strong affiliation with the government in Tobruk. And then we have another kind of middleway entity, which is the newly established government of national accord led by Siraj as a political settlement mediated by the United Nations in 2014 and throughout 2015. So for the last 6 months, we have seen that this general national accord came into effect diplomatically, politically, and Faiz Sarraj became officially the new prime minister. However, I don't see he has much leverage because he is now being sandwiched between the power of the East and also the counter-resistance of the West between Tobruk and Tripoli. And he hasn't been able to bring certain influential figures like Aqila, like Haftar, aboard the proposed presidential council. So we have a government on paper. However, it does not exercise sovereignty. It does not run the local or the national politics. So it's like a frozen political entity till we solve the conflict between Tobruk and Tripoli. Otherwise, we will have two main sources or two centers of power fighting each other, and Siraj become a de facto mediator more than a ruling prime minister or a somebody with influence on the ground.
The government of National Accord is calling on all factions to meet to discuss the way forward. Would that work without international mediation?
I think the negotiation path did not pay enough attention to the factor of people like Khalifa Haftar, because he was not perceived as a facilitator or a nice guy. He was always being marginalized. There were some suspicions that he is maybe a new version of Gaddafi. And now we see that we have this strong, powerful man who is now calling the shots in the east as well as in the west, as he plans. And there is also some regional support that makes him believe that he will succeed and he will implement his ambitions. I'm referring to the Egyptian support since he announced he would be coming back to politics.
Mohammed Shekarwi is a former member of the UN panel of experts and professor of conflict resolution at George Mason University near Washington. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed Elshenawy.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Keith Holmes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next on Let's Talk, single parents' numbers are on the rise. What are the challenges they face and how do they cope with work and children responsibilities? Join host Sande Shomari and his guests discussing single parents. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.